What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. The University of Chicago Economics Department, perhaps they would resent it if you said that they're like famously a home of monsters, but they are certainly famously a home of economists who have had like a huge influence on the United States and the world, to often in very controversial ways. As a shorthand, it's often associated with a kind of libertarian free market economics. Now, in the last week, the department has come under scrutiny again because a retiring professor, Stephen Levitt, famous for his book Freakonomics, gave an interview where he went over some old disputes and accusations of toxicity in the economics department. Now, there's a certain amount of sort of gossipy interest in all this. I would say, like academia is not is known for infighting, but economics in particular, I think, for a variety of reasons that one could explain historically, tends to attract a particular breed of alpha male douchebags that love to mistreat each other. But because of the importance of the University of Chicago Economics Department, I think this internal politics is worth thinking about a little bit, but also thinking about where economics is. So to talk about that, I'm very happy to have on as returning guest Marshall Steinbaum, who studied at the University of Chicago, is now teaches at Utah, and is a longtime critic of many trends within the his profession or his discipline. So let's just start with just what is exactly going on there. Why did this podcast interview on the Capitalism and Freedom podcast with Stephen Levitt, which I will link to, why did that cause such a stir?
Great. Well, Jeet, thank you very much for having me back on the podcast. As always, one of my favorites, and especially love to be on to gossip about my discipline whenever something like this happens. So why is there so much controversy over this particular podcast interview? Levitt's a big deal. He obviously wrote this best-selling book. He won the John Bates Clark Medal, which is a sort of big rising star type honor sometime in the early 2000s. In the interview that's now getting so much attention, Levitt references a profile of him that was done in the New York Times, I want to say around 2003 or 2004, maybe it was on the occasion of him winning that medal. And I read that at the time. In fact, I think I read that I was an undergrad, and I think I recall my mother sending that to me and saying, look, this, you study economics, look at this guy, what do you think of him? And I thought, wow, this is what I want to be when I grow up, even though I was already an adult at the time. So Levitt matters, and or at least, mattered at one time. And I think the sort of valedictory interview on the occasion of his retirement is notable just even before the recording gets started, because he's only about 57, 58, something like that right now, which is young to retire as a professor, especially if you have an appointment at a top department like that. Academia is kind of known for gerontocracy, especially these days. I can testify to that firsthand. I teach a nice paper about the elimination of mandatory retirement ages in law faculties that shows a sort of decisive effect on faculty sticking around long past their sell-by date. So the general tenor within any academic department is going to be people stick around until, they literally can't make it to the office and have to be pushed out. So here's Levitt, big-time economist, retiring at a relatively young age. And, he didn't win a Nobel Prize. I mean, I don't want to overly weight that in interpreting these events, but time was, it was basically considered that the John Bates Clark Medal would be the kind of pre-Nobel Prize for an up-and-comer. And he didn't win one, and he hasn't really been active in cutting-edge research for, 10, 15 years, something like that. In the interview, he says, I have actually been active in cutting-edge research, at least as I conceive it, but it hasn't done very well, so I felt my time was up, basically because, you know, kind of the taste among my colleagues for the type of work that I do has diminished considerably, so that's why I'm retiring and basically only consulting going forward. So, you know, all of that is a very interesting context. Then within the interview, he dishes on what was going on in the UChicago econ department in the 1990s and early 2000s when he was coming up. And in particular, he dishes on the toxic seminar culture in particular, but also the exploitation of graduate students and, you know, kind of clash of egos, pecking order of intelligence. I mean, I thought it was very telling that a number of times in the interview, he alludes to himself or other people essentially privately ranking people, their colleagues, their students, whatever, in terms of their brilliance and their future promise. And that is absolutely typical of the economics profession. There's these sort of tacit private rankings that people carry around that they may talk to one another about that are, you know, enormously decisive to the fate of people's professional careers and that are basically left unsaid. I mean, the faculty will, you know, on occasion talk about this among themselves in an official capacity when, for example, departing PhD students are coming up on the job market and the question is who should be referred at which potential job. But overall, this idea of this kind of internalized hierarchy based on intelligence is absolutely typical among economists. And I thought, you know, quite telling that Levitt basically lays it bare. And that is at the root, as you yourself said in the introduction, that's at the root of toxic culture within economics, because I don't think it takes anyone much difficulty to figure out that that kind of a culture is going to be very white male dominated, very exclusionary to people who are kind of coded as not belonging. Oh, I should also say the other aspect of the interview that I found very telling was Levitt wears on his sleeve his ideological kind of preconceptions in getting into economics. He says, I, you know, always thought markets work best. I took the biggest class at Harvard when I was an undergrad because it had the, you know, because I assumed that if it had the highest enrollment, that must mean it's the best class. And that's kind of the application of my economic thinking in the real world. And on that score, you know, he's he's pretty typical. So one of the dimensions in which you rank economists privately according to their future promise or brilliance or however you're going to conceive of this ranking, you know, that already basically says right up front there's an ideological component to that test. And obviously that too is going to be exclusionary.
Yeah. And now in terms of this toxic culture, he seems to, a lot of it is tied up with particular feuds that he had within the discipline. And these are sort of feuds that you have written about as well before. So, like, is there any sort of revelation or at least clarification on the nature of his fights with his colleagues?
Yeah, so at that very high level, I wouldn't say not really. The main feud that he talks about is between himself and Professor James Heckman, who's considerably older. I think Heckman's got to be maybe 80. So, you know, a full generation, if not a generation and a half older in academic terms than Levitt. Heckman had already been at Chicago for a long time when Levitt got there in the late 90s or early 2000s, and basically seems to have, you know, kind of developed an allergic reaction to him right off the bat. That and Levitt speaks about this kind of, you know, deeply awkward, you know, potentially borderline mentally deranged kind of conduct on Heckman's part, because on the one hand, so one of the revelations that's gotten a lot of attention is Heckman created an entire seminar series just to attack Levitt, a junior faculty in his own department. So like, okay, that's obviously a hostile reception if you're that junior faculty, even if you come in as a big hotshot, which I guess Levitt was at the time. And the nature of the dispute is, let me try to not dwell too much on this, but and rather elucidate it. Levitt's contribution is to look at relationships between what economists would call endogenous variables. So, for example, the effect of police on crime. Mm-hmm. If you hire more police, does it cause crime to go down? That's a hard question to answer within an economic model. So this is what Levitt would call a structural approach, because if you try to kind of set up a model of crime, you know, the question of how many police get hired within a model and how much crime responds to that, those are both going to be outcomes that the model attempts to predict. So rather than do all of that, all of the kind of setting up of a model and say, okay, well, the model predicts that more police cause crime to go down, and let me test that prediction, he just goes directly to the data. I mean, this is giving him this is the way he would want the distinction to be presented. He goes directly to the data, looks for what's called quasi-exogenous variation in the amount of police, and says, what happened to crime after that, you know, when we have this quasi-exogenous variation, that's my answer. And he talks in the interview about how influential a paper along those lines was in the 1990s, basically because politicians, specifically the Clinton White House, wanted to pass the 1995 crime bill. And his paper said, oh, hiring a lot more police, which was an item in the bill, will cause crime to go down. And, you know, that was telling powerful people what they wanted to hear. And so they elevated his research. And he's, you know, quite forthcoming about interpreting what the events in that way. Heckman is what would be called structural. So everything is the result of an economic model. As I described it, you aren't doing economics unless you write down a model and then estimate its parameters. And then that is what enables you to influence policy, because using a model, you can perform counterfactuals. So you estimate the model on real data, police affect crime somehow, and then you say, okay, within this model I just set up and estimated, what would happen if I reduce the amount of police or some adjustment like that? Then I'm in a position to say, to perform policy counterfactuals. And Heckman basically thought that Levitt was a glorified consultant, you know, not really doing serious economics research. To do serious economics research is to engage in this structural estimation, as Heckman would call it.
Okay. Oh, I should mention that Heckman is 79. So like getting in exactly the range that you had kind of mentioned. Now, it should be mentioned, I mean, like, as you describe it, you know, I am not unsympathetic to sort of Heckman, leaving aside whatever toxic behavior he had, because if you look at Levitt's career, like, it seems to me that what he basically did was find ways to come up with very disputable conclusions based on like data sets that were either pleasing to political constituencies of a moment, like the political class, like with the more police, less crime, or were just even more trivial, where just like entertaining anecdotes that one could tell. You know, and his famous book Freakonomics is kind of filled with that stuff. And so it does seem like he turned economics into a kind of parlor game of, you mentioned, you know, the police and crime thing. I believe that his example or his evidence was that, like, well, you know, mayors, when it comes close to elections, will hire more police, and then we can use that to measure whether crime goes down or not. And I think there's been a critique of that, like, were actually more police hired, or did they just promise to hire more police? And empirical basis.
I was going to say that I totally agree with your characterization of this, Gene. Let's come back to the flaws in Levitt's approach in a second. Yeah. The attitude that you outlined about Heckman having the more rigorous, more scientific, in air quotes, approach, that's exactly how I felt about this when I was in graduate school in Chicago. I didn't study with either of those two. The fields that I studied even then are different than what I study now, but weren't what those two studied. So I didn't really have direct contact with either of them. But insofar as I was aware of this raging dispute, I thought, you know, Heckman has the goods in terms of how to do economics. He's just a giant asshole. I hope I can say that on this podcast. Okay. You know, so like that's the nature of this dispute, is that he's in the right, but is one of these giant egos that's way out of control and exploiting graduate students. I should say my views on that have changed. I think we should come back to kind of how that assessment of the dispute has evolved since my time in graduate school and larger developments in the profession. Yeah, it absolutely bears stating up front that Levitt's groundbreaking research that won him that John Bates Clark Medal and basically populates the book Freakonomics has not stood up to the test of time, you know, for kind of basic data science reasons. And, you know, so on the police and crime one, the flaw was there isn't really what we call a first stage. That is to say, the elections don't actually cause more police to be hired. So it's like, okay, if there's not a quote unquote first stage, then you don't have a valid instrument, obviously. But, you know, he's famous for this idea that Roe v. Wade caused the decline in crime in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at the time I thought, oh, you know, that's obviously a controversial statement, but it kind of makes sense to me as a naive youngster in the 2000s. I've since been more attuned to this is basically eugenics as a critique since then, but also that finding hasn't held up either. So my attitude used to be like, okay, you know, it makes sense as a possibility, but that possibility has been ruled out by the empirical analysis. So whatever, I mean, that can happen in science. The other instance that weighs heavily on me and I think should be brought into this discussion, which is this then PhD student economist Emily Oster had published this paper basically claiming that there was not sex selective abortion and infanticide in East and South Asia, contrary to what had been alleged by Amartya Sen, and her kind of explanation for what really caused gender disparities in populations. populations in that region was misinterpretation of the prevalence of a different type of hepatitis than actually causes differences in gender of delivered babies and so on. So it was like this whole argument fell apart. Levitt had championed her as a graduate student and published that paper as, you know, her job market paper or something, or paper she wrote while in graduate school. He published that when he was editor of the Journal of Political Economy. And then, you know, they all, both Oster and Levitt, you know, admirably basically acceded to the criticism that when it came out that the paper was wrong. But it was telling, you know, I haven't had my papers championed by senior scholars and, you know, kind of published preferentially in top journals. She was telling him the kind of thing he wanted to hear as a journal editor that he elevated that then later fell apart. So I think we have to interpret the sort of not great long-term fate of the career-making work that he did as, you know, constitutive of his legacy in the discipline. And that may have something to do, I mean, I would guess that has something to do with what he was saying his frustrations were about getting papers published in the most recent 10 or 15 years.
Yeah, no, I mean, it does seem like the sort of Freakonomics approach is to, like, if you can come up with a sort of counterintuitive thing, a sort of, you know, something that you can, at a cocktail party, tell somebody, and they'll say, oh, that's really neat, you know?
Like, that's right.
But I mean, that's not, and to me, like, the, you know, one can dispute, like, you know, how much a discipline should be empirical or theoretical. But to me, like, the core problem is, I don't actually think real life presents the kind of clean-cut cases where you can, like, do control groups and say, you know, this happened, and therefore that's the cause. I just don't think that's the way reality works, and therefore...
Oh, okay. Well, okay. Well, Gene, I have to stop you there because you've just, by that statement, ruled out, you know, basically everything on my CV. As invalid. So what I
no,
the
no,
way
no,
I would
no 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 no. But I mean, I mean, in the way, I mean, I think specifically the Levitt type approach, where you're kind of looking for this, like, oh wow moment. You know,
that's exactly where I would take it, which you know, the world is complicated. And also, if you do get those kind of oh wow moments for a cocktail party, they're not going to tell you anything interesting in a broader sense. They're good enough for a cocktail party anecdote, but not a lot much more than that. So this gets us to sort of why I have a different take on the Levitt-Heckman dispute now than I did when I was a graduate student kind of living through it, is the field really has gone away from both Levitt's kind of let's answer the questions that we can and leave the big ones aside because we can't answer them. It's gone to let's actually answer the big questions, even though it's a lot harder than writing a little paper that one person can do at their desk. You know, so if I think of like what my day-to-day life consists of, it is trying to get access to data sets and negotiating that access so that I can answer such big questions. And when I look at the types of papers that get published in top journals nowadays that I most admire, it is, you know, years, if not decades, of painstaking work linking together enormous data sets to tell us something really important about the world. So, you know, I'm just, like a paper I taught this past in the current semester is looking at the effect of part of the 1996 welfare reform that did actually mean that, you know, one group of people that would have remained eligible for supplemental security income, that is a disability benefit for low-income people, that would have remained eligible prior to the reform, suddenly became ineligible. So you have like a big benefit denial, basically, to people who would have gotten it. Let's look at the long-run impact of that benefit denial from 1996 when they were children and got these benefits denied to, you know, whatever they've been doing in their adult life. You know, so I should credit the author is Menashe Deshpande, also at the University of Chicago Economics Department. She's demonstrative of what economics has become, which is, you know, spend a lot of time learning a very complicated and hard to get data set. Do find the quasi-exogenous variation she did in the case of the welfare reform. So, you know, your statement like the world just doesn't work that way. Sometimes it does, but you have to work a lot harder than Levitt did for his cocktail party anecdotes.
Well, no, exactly. And I want to say something about the ideological or social historical preconditions of Levitt's triviality, which is that, you know, like he sort of graduated around like the early 90s, I believe 94 from MIT. And this is like, you know, this is the sort of Fukuyama moment, the end of history moment, you know, like we basically have achieved everything. And therefore, you know, I mean, in some ways, he is like a line out of the end of history, which is said, you know, the end of history will be a very boring time where people will be taken up with trivial issues. And then because everything, you know, the work of the human history of this, you know, grand battles between capitalism and communism have been solved. If that is your, you know, your initial premise, then yes, of course, you know, doing the Freakonomic things makes sense. And it seems to me that what the ideological, this underscores that the discipline, you know, responds to the historical situation. The shift in the discipline, to me, seems to come out of the 2008 moment, where like, oh wow, it turned out we hadn't actually solved all the political and economic problems. They're actually very big problems, and you know, and one saw, you know, coming out of that, both social movements like Occupy Wall Street, and then also the success of Piketty's capital in the 21st century, which I think, you know, is perhaps a marker of its time, just as Fukuyama was.
I'm so glad you
mentioned the return of big questions.
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned Piketty, because that's exactly where I was going to go. I think it's absolutely right to date the start of the transition to the financial crisis and the kind of marker of the transition to the publication of Capital in the 21st century. This weighs heavily on me in particular because I started at the University of Chicago the fall that Lehman Brothers failed, and I ended the spring that Capital in the 21st century was published. And I basically felt like I didn't learn anything about how things actually work over that 6-year period until I read Pat Capital in the 21st century, basically after my thesis was accepted, not literally after it was accepted, but after I'd done everything, gotten an entire PhD, I finally read a book that actually had something to say about how the economy worked. And I do think that you know, so my career is decisively demarcated by the events that you mentioned. I think it's not out of the, you know, crazy to ascribe that to the field as a whole, because, you know, when I think about like the beginning of when I started to see papers of the kind that I just outlined, that I actually thought, oh, that's really interesting and cool. That's the kind of work I would want to do as an economist. That's basically postdates my time in graduate school. I didn't see any of that when I was getting my PhD.
Yeah. So the discipline itself has changed. In some ways, I think this Levitt-Heckman dispute, like, then does seem kind of anachronistic, or it's people are, you know, like, it's, I guess, like old timers thinking about, well, remember when Ali fought Foreman, right? People are reliving the great battles of their youth, right, that in a lot of ways are no longer speak to the current moment. Now, but I think one reason that maybe the interview, you know, got a lot of attention, and it is something a lot of people in, you know, sort of the economics field are talking about, is, you know, like, it raises this issue of, you know, the toxic culture. And you didn't mention the story, but I mean, like, one of the things that Heckman apparently did was, like, he brought in a sort of critic of Levitt who brought it into a seminar that Levitt was doing his own slides. And so it's not just like, you know, this is more a seminar where you present something and so someone says, oh, this is more of a comment than a question. It's, this is a comment, and by the way, I have these slides to dispute you. And like, all the better, because the person who was bringing the slides was, I'll let you explain who that was.
I don't actually remember who it was.
The guns guy.
John Lott. Yes, yeah, yeah. So John Lott actually sued Levitt. I learned that from this whole back and forth. I didn't know that. I also didn't realize that John Lott had been a professor at the University of Chicago at that time. So,
which is scandalous.
That's before my time. In my time, he has been kind of factotum at the American Enterprise Institute, who does crappy research on guns. You know, I mean, his book is called More Guns, Less Crime. And the dispute that you're referring to is basically between Lott claiming that the decline in crime in the 1990s was actually due to concealed carry, you know, that is to say the criminals worried that they're going to get shot back basically by everyone carrying guns around, versus Levitt saying it's caused by abortion. So, you know, if you think of the kind of either of those hypotheses have failed in the intervening years, not terribly well. Now, Levitt says that Lott sued him in federal court for defamation, I assume saying that the gun thing was nonsense. You know, I didn't know that at all, but can you imagine? Imagine like an academic seminar dispute devolving into a lawsuit.
I should say, and I don't want to cause a lawsuit here, but I mean, I would encourage people to, like, you know, just do a search on Lott and the sort of critiques that have been made of his scholarship. But I will say, like, I mean, if you look at the dispute, like, it is, you know, one person saying, you know, to solve crime, we need more guns, and the other person saying to solve crime, we need, like, more abortions to get rid of the underclass. I mean, that is the sort of narrow parameters of politics. Of sort of like, you know, Clinton versus Bush, or Clinton versus Doyle, or even like, you know, Gore versus Bush. I mean, it is of that moment where it's like, you know, like the most conservative form of liberalism versus like, you know, the sort of frankly not so right. So, I mean, to the extent that, you know, there has been progress, and it's tied in with the idea of sort of ideological shifts in the discipline. I mean, we do have like a little bit of a wider spectrum, so that you know, do have some voices that are not just like very right-wing liberals.
I mean, yeah. I think that that's also a good way of kind of segueing to where things stand now, because yes, we definitely have a wider spectrum. You know, the types of work that's getting published in top journals now is not of the Levitt or the Heckman variety. I think there's a backlash against that, though. So that kind of gets us to like, okay, what is this these stories about toxicity in the discipline 20 or 30 years ago have to do with the potential for toxicity in the discipline right now? I think we are in a moment, you know, so I think it's fair to say that the US has had a kind of anti-racist backlash since 2020. You know, that is represented in the economics profession and in the larger kind of, I would say, public debate about higher education and the role that it plays in society. So I'm thinking here, for example, of the congressional hearings about supposed anti-Semitism on campus that really were witch hunts against these university administrators who were perceived by Congress and their kind of critics in the public as like diversity hires, to use a loaded phrase. You know, that is quite continuous with economics toxicity in the following way. So Claudine Gay, when she had resigned as president of Harvard in the aftermath of this. Before that, she was the dean of arts and sciences at Harvard. I didn't realize this at when it was happening, but she is perceived to have been the main antagonist to Roland Fryer, who was this economics professor in the Harvard department, who was put on leave and I think prevented from teaching and supervising and kind of denied access to his own research institute on campus due to sexist comments and a kind of climate of sexual harassment that he fostered at the institution that he ran. So, you know, you have one academic administrator basically throwing the book at a, you know, at someone who you could say it represents the toxic culture in the profession, then that academic administrator getting promoted to yet a higher position, president of Harvard, and then all these people that were basically friends or allies of Fryer in a kind of intellectual alliance sort of way, kind of taking their vengeance on Gay when she was herself vulnerable due to this congressional hearing. And, you know, there's very direct relations here. I mean, there's, you know, a lot of, like, if you look at the sources for Bill Ackman's claims that Gay had plagiarized her own academic work, he's referring to someone named Chris Brunet, who is a PhD program dropout in economics, who is a notorious, troll is understating the toxicity from him. Yeah. I mean, if you go to his Substack, you will find the most vile racist and sexist types of comments. You know, Ackman is openly citing this guy, you know, so this is, you know, we know in the general, you know, in conservatism, they're very good at kind of laundering the worst product of their, you know, deepest swamp or whatever, and making it socially acceptable in mainstream society. And this is definitely an example of that. You know, I've been surprised that Brunet hasn't gotten more scrutiny in this whole conflict. So he basically took revenge on Claudine Gay for going after Roland Fryer. I mean, his view would be going after Roland Fryer. My view would be Fryer committed heinous acts and doesn't belong in a university setting. And, you know, kind of took her scalp, basically. And that's not, you know, a one-off example for what's going on in the discipline right now. I mean, I'm thinking as well. So I wrote a piece about this conflict that happened in 2020, like directly around the killing of George Floyd, that Harold Ulich, who was editor of the Journal of Political Economy at the time, who's another senior professor, kind of Levitt's vintage within the department, although he's a macroeconomist, he had been denounced by Black PhD students for basically making kind of racist comments to the side when he was lecturing, and was, quote, investigated by the university and exonerated pretty quickly. And I wrote a piece in the aftermath of that, that basically, you know, this kind of, you know, internal reckoning was going to get, you know, was well needed, but not sufficient. So like the investigation is never going to cleanse the discipline of its legacy of racism. Mm-hmm. Ulich is also, so anyway, Ulich's still there. You know, he's obviously has sort of right-wing affinities. This was also notable within the UChicago department around, there was a killing of an Asian graduate student a few years ago, basically a street violence in Chicago. And, you know, the department was like, I would say, egging on the racial conflict associated with that case in a way that, you know, I thought was like, okay, well, you know, this is basically going to lead to like out and out riotous violence on the campus of the University of Chicago. Now, thankfully, that hasn't happened, but, you know, it was, you know, very much kind of embracing the conflict, and you know, you could see exactly where that would lead. The department's also opposed, so there was this new department within the College of Social Science at Chicago called like the Department of Race, Diaspora, and Indigeneity that the that the economics department opposed the creation of that new department. And not only did they oppose the creation of it, they said that creating that department violated the so-called Chicago principles. So the Chicago principles are one of these sort of totems of right-wing free speech and academia type mantras or statements. And the idea, and you know, what they say is, you know, all sides should be heard. We should have free and open debate, that kind of thing. The idea that creating a department would violate that principle is almost is astounding, because they're essentially alleging that studying race qua race is not hearing from all sides. And that is really what I was getting at in that 2020 article about Ulich, which is this is a department that studies race thither and yon, not particularly well. And there's no black people, no, you know, basically no people of color, at least at that time, in the department. So they're saying we're allowed to study race. We white economists are allowed to study race. But if you create a whole department whose appointments we don't control to study race, also under the letterhead of the University of Chicago College of Social Science, that is somehow a violation of our academic freedom or something like that. Somehow, like, you know, rules out our necessary point of view and exiles it from campus in violation of these principles. It's very telling and also threatening, I would say, to like genuine academic freedom and robust discourse and scholarship.
Yeah, so I mean, it's a very different type of toxicity, and but again, with our sort of emphasis on, you know, the influence of history, historical moments, it is very much tied to the sort of backlash politics that has sort of overtaken the sort of center and center liberals institutions since 2020.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, and it's
coming. I feel like it's more present in economics than most economists would like to admit or be in touch with.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would imagine, like, I mean, it is a kind of notoriously male and white discipline. And then there was, like, you know, attempts to, there have been attempts to change that. And that itself, you know, like, furnishes ample grounds for backlash politics. But then also, like, all the scrutiny of, you know, the sort of listservs and the what people are saying. In some ways, yeah, I mean, it does seem like it's very much tied to the, as I said before, the historical moment. Like, it does seem, but also tied maybe to the larger history of Chicago economics. I mean, I'm thinking of sort of Milton Friedman's, you know, basic arguments for student vouchers, you know, that, well, then people can choose whether they want segregated schools or non-segregated schools, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So it's a kind of enhancement of freedom that is actually, like, you know, a way of maintaining the racial status quo.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely an accurate interpretation of the way the department has kind of confronted 2020. That's for sure. And I think it's, you know, as I've been saying, basically, you know, more a harbinger of the future than it is a throwback to the past.
Yeah.
It's continuous with the past for all the what you just said, but, you know, it's not like what worries me most of all is the idea that, oh, you know, in the bad old days, things were bad, but they're better now. So anything I've been saying about how the disciplines evolved since the Heckman-Levitt years for the better, you know, yes, but that doesn't mean things are better now.
Yeah, no, I mean, that there is a kind of newer threat in it. And in some ways, I mean, this is a point that you've made before in some of your writing, like the sort of Levitt-Heckman dispute, you know, like, is it, you know, it's Tweedledee and Tweedledum. It's a dispute with people, you know, like, who are working within fairly narrow kind of parameters. Whereas the sort of current backlash and the current toxicity is of a piece of, you know, the shift towards bigger questions.
Like, that's right. The right way to interpret it is that you have these narrow parameters in Tweedledee and Tweedledum. Nowadays, you have wider parameters. So definitely not the most right-wing version of liberalism as the leftmost pole of the economics discipline. But you've also got fascism, frankly. And that's reflective of our political system.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So this has been, like, a great conversation, very enlightening for me, and I hope for the listeners. So I want to thank Marshall for coming on the program.
Thank you very much, Gene. I always love to come on and discuss the dark underbelly of the economics discipline.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.